Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast, episode number 31. This episode is with a friend of mine, Seth Taylor. We went to grad school together, and his story is so authentic, and what he's sharing is so important and amazing, and I'm so grateful that he was willing to share his story on the podcast. Please remember, as I say with every podcast episode, that everything we talk about is our opinion. This is not a replacement for healthcare services. This is for educational purposes only and storytelling. Stay tuned for a really beautiful story and what I believe to be the truth about healing, tapping into the subconscious. It's a really beautiful conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Everything expressed in the Live Your Life podcast is either my opinion or the opinion of my guest, and this is not a replacement for healthcare services. If you find yourself in need of therapy or other healthcare services, please seek out resources for that. I'm Jasmine Savari, and welcome to the Live Your Life podcast. As a coach with a master's degree in psychology, I know that so many of us are missing the authentic experience of truly living our lives. I want to inspire you with conversations that expand your consciousness and empower you to create the best life possible. Let's start living now, because now is all we have. Seth, welcome to the Live Your Life podcast.
Thank you, Jazz. Big fan. Huge fan of the dancing and everything else that you do. So, excited to be here.
Your excitement is all over your life. I just feel it every time I connect with you. And I feel like you're one of the most genuine people you really care about. Like, I feel like you really care about me, and I know you really care about people. So that's just a side note. So I'm really happy to have you here.
Thank you.
And I know that we have a lot to talk about. So the reason I reached out to you was based on a book you wrote about a pilgrimage. So I want to share with everybody that some of like how we know each other and what we've done together.
Yeah.
So we met in grad school, as we were just talking, 2011. Did you start the same year as me then?
I started 2010. I'm a freak of nature there. I actually started in the winter, semester, which almost never happens. So I did it kind of wonky.
Okay. So we met probably when I arrived, which was 2011. And then in 2013, we went on a pilgrimage through school to an island called Iona, which is two islands off the northern coast of Scotland, which was a beautiful experience, which inspired you to create something. So why don't you share just some of your story? Like, what do you think people should know about you? And then let's talk about what you've created.
Okay. Yeah. I, like anybody who's really creating things in the world, came from a pretty tremendous amount of suffering. I was a missionary kid raised by missionaries in Africa. And, you know, my father was killed on the field, and you know, when I was 12, and I was raised in a pretty toxic religious space, and which of course manifested in all kinds of anxiety and intense depression, and addiction, specifically to pornography and gambling, when I was in my 20s and 30s. So right into my early part of my marriage, when I got married, when I was 27. And when I was about 33, the suffering kind of came to its peak. And which of course is usually when we actually kind of find the opening to healing. And so I was able to do some actual energy healing. Like I started with working at this place up in Alaska called the White Raven Center. And they were teaching me about trauma as a repressed energy in the body, specifically focusing on energy. And that was my first experience of that. And to be honest with you, like the healing was so intense and so fast. Like my addiction was gone in about 2 weeks of doing some sessions there, and then just working on what they were telling me to do. And then of course my religion started to deconstruct from that space, because when you have an actual experience of the spirit and this intense healing, it certainly throws you for a loop. So I started deconstructing, and really I ended up at the Seattle school because my belief systems were starting to shatter, and I didn't know what to do. And I'd heard Rob Bell online. I'd started reading some of Rob Bell's stuff, and I saw that he was speaking there. And so I watched a thing, and then my brother was like, dude, you should go check that out. So I ended up just, you know, going to visit. And I think I kind of hobbled into the Seattle school with my beliefs like shattered in my hands, kind of going like, can anybody like help me put this back together, please? And I went looking for a new expression, I think, of the Christian story. And I really didn't, I had no idea. I was a sales guy at the time. I'd been doing sales for 10 years and I hated it. And I had no sense of purpose. I mean, I kicked the addiction fast, but the depression and the anxiety, especially the depression and that purposeless life that I've been living with no sense of what I wanted to do or be in the world, was really why I was there. So I was one of those weird people. You probably don't even know this, Jazz, but like when I was at Seattle School, I never to this day do not know one single grade I got on anything ever. Like, you know, they had that big cabinet where they return the papers.
Yeah.
Like I went to that cabinet twice in 4 years and just grabbed all the papers out, walked over the garbage can, and just threw them away.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Because I wasn't there. I went there on a serious quest. Like I was there to learn. I hardly took any notes. I just sat and listened and soaked everything in. And if you were ever in a class with me, I was constantly engaging with questions. Yes, I was there.
I remember.
Yeah. I was just there. I was exploring the depth of myself. And when I'm doing, we're doing, you know, for listeners, like you probably know this by now if you listen to Jazz podcast, but we had to do a lot of therapy while we were there. We had to do this thing called practicum and you just kind of get torn apart. On the side, I was exploring energy work. So I was exploring deep energetic healing because I was looking at this whole therapeutic kind of world and I was seeing a lot of people that become codependent on it. I was seeing a lot of people that become hyper self-aware but don't seem to change. And I had this spiritual perspective having gone through this really intense healing, but also like I was somebody who was raised on Bible. And so I had this really intense kind of, my deconstruction didn't make me believe less in God. It made me dare to believe in God more, but kind of get rid of the dogma. And I just started going, if it's real, we shouldn't have to believe in it. So if God is real, belief shouldn't be a requirement. It should be able to be experienced. If it's real, you can experience it. So if there is any actual power, that was my big quest. Where's the power? I was raised with stories and miracles and Bible stories and Jesus is healing people left and right. And I'm looking at a Christian world that is approaching pornography addiction and things like that with this total just behavioral mentality and this really guilt-driven, shame-driven, sin-driven kind of concept. And I was looking at that and I'm looking at therapy where it's just this kind of years and years of becoming aware of oneself. Especially we were trained in psychodynamic therapy, right? Psychodynamic was this, we're becoming aware of all these kind of shattered parts of us, but I was meeting too many people that didn't seem to change. They were super self-aware. And they would do it, had a lot of, you know, they took a lot of bubble baths with candlelights and lots of self-care and a lot of, you know, we were taught this kind of self-love, self-care concept as a way of dealing with these shattered parts of us that we were becoming aware of. But I was just going, man, anything that the spirit was always kind of bugging me, anything that can be broken can be healed and that we should be able to shift permanently. And so I was really exploring it while I was there. I was just exploring, like, is there a place where we just feel different, where my insecurities, rather than becoming aware of them and becoming friends with them in some way, which I'm not saying is a bad thing unto itself, but if it is limiting what we're capable of being, is it possible to heal it? It's where I just change. I am different than I was before. I am not the insecure person I was before. And can we do it faster? If spirit is real, I mean, I'm watching Jesus lay his hands on people and bang, you know, as I'm going, man, there's got to be a more powerful way. So I was doing this deep energy, spiritual exploration in my healing while I was alongside all this other traditional stuff and what we were learning at school. And so it was my 4 years at Seattle School were extremely intense. Mm-hmm. And the whole time too, I was doing a faith experiment, which was, I told my wife I quit my sales job. And then we got two kids because someone gave us a baby. Like, hey, baby's doing 2 months. You want her? And we're like, and we'd never been able to have kids. So we're like, sure. And then 8 months later, we get pregnant, like the only pregnancy we've ever had. So two kids and no jobs. Because I just told her, I said, I'm never going to look for a job again. I said, if a job gets offered to me, any job that gets offered to me, if I didn't look for it, I'm going to say yes. And I'm going to trust that the spirit is leading me to try to get out. Because poverty was a huge part of my upbringing and a huge part of the depression, the lack of creativity and all that kind of thing. And over time, I mean, of course, I'm getting humiliated and crushed in these minimum wage jobs while I'm doing this thing and they've got the two kids coming and I'm trying to, it was just this insane time of just cracking open. Most of the time, I couldn't afford to get to school. I mean, I would take the subway, you know, the light rail, and I'd just stay by the door. And if one of the fare collectors would get on, I'd just check every single time we'd stop. I'd see someone get on, I'd get off and then wait for the next train. Like that was a lot of how I got to school because I couldn't afford parking and I couldn't afford to drive and I couldn't afford the gas. And I mean, there was times where I went hungry. I mean, I went 2 weeks with only eating my kids' leftovers at one point. And I mean, it was a very, very intense time of building my faith and transforming my internal being. And from it came a very interesting marriage of a deep energy work with a psychodynamic kind of bent to it, which is basically what created, you know, my pilgrimage and this type of healing work that we do now with people. And what I've kind of taken into my life coaching, and I do very high level therapy work right now with professional athletes. That's my main focus. I work with other people, but most of the people I work with are athletes now. And the idea is to try to build, if you bring joy back to the experience of the game, if we rework the fundamentals of your identity by healing deep trauma, will it make you a better player and it will make you a happier person? And that's the project. So it's kind of a big research project essentially that I'm doing now. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I mean, just like anything worth doing, that answers so many questions, but I have like way more questions now.
Right on.
Okay. So first of all, I just want to, the last thing that you said, I think I really love this idea of, it's something that I've learned in A Course in Miracles, but it's this framework of like, content and then it's cause and effect. And I think, so you're working with athletes, right? And it's like what a lot of us, I'm not an athlete. I mean, I guess I am in my own way, but,
would think
if I just, I am super athletic, but I'm not competitive, but it's like this idea probably of why don't you do these things that we can think of with like our logical mind? Like if I, you know, lift more weights or run more or something like that, that would appear to be the answer, but missing the whole psyche, like the subconscious drives that do everything. And so if I believe whatever I believe about myself, if I'm broken or not good enough or whatever, that's going to be the theme of everything that I do. And what I hear you saying is going beneath like the ego ideas of the cognitive, like what I think I should be doing or strategizing or planning, and actually healing the core of who people are, like fundamentally.
Right. Yeah. It's an exploration in the unconscious. But and I think the difference between what you would experience with me or say something that's more, I don't know, I think a lot about Carl Jung, to be honest with you. And obviously I don't know Jung's practice up and down or how he dealt with people. I am much more interested in how do we navigate the unconscious in a way that shifts it fundamentally, mm-hmm. right? Because, I mean, you don't know what you don't know, right? So when someone comes to me, this is why I like working with athletes, because being a pro athlete is just a vocation, okay? And everybody has vocations, and some vocations have more pressure than others. Pro athletes have extreme levels of pressure. And most of them have been doing their vocation since they're about 5, if not younger. I mean, and that's a very rare thing, to have someone's vocation be this super high pressure, in most cases, super high paying, also extremely limited because you're done by your mid-30s if you're lucky. And it's also deeply linked to their trauma. So there's this, it's a really unique space to do healing, because if you can heal inside a pressure cooker, you can heal faster because you're constantly being triggered, constantly being triggered, these guys. And most people are being triggered. Everyone has a context, you know, for their healing and their enlightenment. But pro athletes is a really unique one because, you know, I mean, there's no job security. It's constant pressure. The celebrity is a unique kind of healing place because that's a pressure unto itself and causes people to kind of compartmentalize and dissociate from themselves. And it's a really, really unique context to work with. And so, you know, I found that guys can do, if people are dedicated, you know, if they're really dedicated to the work that I try to do with them, I've seen people do 5 years of 5 years worth of therapy in about 3 months. It's a very, very fascinating thing, but you have to be willing to work at the level where the trauma exists. So if you don't, like, there's a framework. You mind if I just kind of tell you a little bit of the framework that I work with people in?
Yeah, totally. I do have one question. I want to make sure you touch on it. I would imagine like if you're a pro athlete, then you have this maybe ego identity of yourself as if like you're good enough based on performance.
Totally. Yeah.
And would you say that it's harder to access these vulnerable places because it may subconsciously like bring up feelings of weakness or failure if you're not emotionally perfect?
Yeah, that's everything. I mean, athletes are on an extreme level earning love for the most part, especially in the American context. They are trained to earn love. And that's the entire process. And it's fascinating to watch that kind of unearth itself. But what I've found is that, what I do with any athlete when I start with or in my mentorship classes and that kind of, because I teach people this modality. And what I do is I talk about the three layers of feeling. And, you know, I always say, so, you know, if I ask you how you're doing and you go, well, I'm good. They go, okay, great. well, good's not a feeling, right? If I say, how you feeling? Oh, I feel great. Well, okay, well, you know, or I feel, let's say, yeah, I'm not feeling great right now. And I ask you, you know, well, that's not a feeling. If I ask you, what is that? I asked my brother the other day, like, how you feeling? He goes, pretty shitty. I hope you don't mind me. I don't know if you, this you is know, a no
all good,
podcast.
No worries. Okay.
I said, really? I go, what's, and I jokingly said to him, cause he knows what I do. I said, yeah, what's shitty feel like? Because shitty's not a feeling, right? It's a thought. So that's the first layer. First layer, it's not a feeling at all. So I ask you, how you feeling? I feel shitty. That's not a feeling. Second layer, the first layer is thought. Second layer is the emotional. So if I ask him, what shitty feel like? And he finally says, you know, he's able to pinpoint, I'm angry. I feel angry. Yeah. And now most therapy kind of goes to that level. It works on the second level because I could say, well, let's talk about why you're angry. And we can start getting into the stories and the trauma and what's happened in mom and dad and the relationships. And that's where most therapy kind of dwells. But I'm not that interested in staying in that level because I think that it's extremely slow moving and the ego kind of is still kind of the primary operating system. It's getting lost in the stories and the constant self-awareness. I mean, I have friends that are so self-aware, it's ridiculous, but they're still miserable. Right. So I go, okay, well, great. And now if I ask you, what does anger feel like? You know, most people kind of go, huh? You know, but eventually I go, well, what's it feel like in your body? What do you experience? What does anger feel like? And it's fascinating because then I teach people how to pinpoint that, how to show them how to work with the triggers in their life and get beyond the stories and get beyond the second level. And the third level is pure energy. Yeah. And when you work at that level, you work with raw energy. Cause eventually, like I'll give you an example. I had a guy one time, I said, you know, what can I help you with? He's a high school player that was heading to college. And he said, I feel intimidated by players that I know are better than me. I said, oh yeah. I said, well, what's that feel like? And he said, makes me not want to play. I go, well, you know, that's a nice thought. I go, but what's intimidated feel like? What's not wanting to play feel like in your body? And he was a little confused for a second, but eventually he kind of just, you could see his attention. He brought his attention into his body. And we all know that trauma is where the body knows the truth, right? It holds the trauma. So eventually he just goes, it's like a pain in my chest. I'm like, right. Sharp pain? Dull pain? He goes, kind of achy, sharp? I go, oh, okay, now we're feeling. And if you feel it, you can heal it. That's the rule. If you can't feel it, you can't heal it. But if you can teach people how to feel the trauma outside of the stories, we're working with raw energy. And at that level, you can heal fast. Like you can do very, very efficient, very fast healing. And you don't have to swim around in the stories because the truth is your body is always showing you your trauma and you might not understand. And some people are like, well, do I need to know where this came from? No. We don't need to mess around with where it came from. We'll just keep it simple. Probably came from mom and dad. And there's lots of other things. I go, but that world is so big and there's so many dimensions and so much complexity to how the trauma comes in. Let's just accept that it's a part of being a person. And if we can work on this level, we can heal you very, very quickly. And so we work on that level. And that's where some of the understanding of energetics comes in. That's where some of the mysticism, I guess you could say, but it's metaphysical. But I started doing it years ago. And at first I was like, man, it worked on me, but will it work with other people? And I start working with, and then I start seeing these radical shifts. And so I'll watch people kick addiction. I'll watch people end eating disorders in 2 months. I'll watch them. I mean, I've had an eating disorder for 10 years and I don't know if it'll ever change. And 2 months later it's done. And they're just kind of like, whoa. And you watch them learn a new kind of understanding of the blueprint of what makes us human beings. But you really are working identity. I mean, I was working with a guy in the U.S. national team, and literally every session we ended, I said, see, you're earning love again. Those parts of you, those young parts of you that are fractured, they're all trying to get their needs met, man, and they're hijacking your adult life, which is why soccer is just nothing but anxiety, because you're just earning love through the game. You were taught to do that. And that burdens it. What it does is it creates an emotional ceiling over people's lives, not just athletes. With athletes, it's very easy to see because it's such high pressure. But with most people, it's like that. Any person who's working a job right now that they hate, you know what I mean? Anybody who's working, goes to work every day to a job they don't like. There's a profound, you said it yourself, there seems to be a logical choice. Just don't do that anymore. But they still do. And the question, of course, is why? And then we have to be able to get down to the level of where that reality got created. And that's what I teach people now. So it's a fun thing. And with the athletes, it's kind of an added bonus. You get to watch it play out on TV, which is kind of fun, you know, because you really get to see in the body language and the nuance of their performance and then watching them kind of come alive. And, you know, I worked with this guy who was like, I hate this. And his injury, he was constantly being injured. and he hated soccer and he wasn't living up to his potential. And we did this really deep work. And then he came back from this injury that he was rehabbing, and MLS comeback player of the year. Last year was best 11. Now he's in Europe. But he's happy too. Asked his girlfriend to marry him after all these years, like finally moved out of his parents' house. That's what's fascinating. He was making $1 million a year, still living at home. So it's just but you can watch these really, really big shifts, and you give them, the idea is to give them a paradigm where they can heal themselves now, and they can go forward and they understand how to do, they have spiritual practices and they have practices that help them heal themselves. So ultimately it puts them on a path to enlightenment, which I think is good therapy. But that's the goal.
So this concept of energy, I think sometimes that's hard to wrap our minds around because there's so many different ways that it's talked about and used. So I'm wondering if you're open to sharing more about your personal experience and really what that looked like.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. I've become a bit of a student of quantum physics, okay, in an attempt to bring some scientific language to these things. Because at first, it was explained to me that when I was working at White Raven Center up in Anchorage, Alaska, if anybody's curious, whiteravencenter.org, fascinating place. It was really explained to me very simply, but I was working with people that were working in, it's psychology, but they were working in modalities that kind of found their roots in some of the native traditions. So you could almost call it shamanistic at some level. It was breath work. It was deep breath to access repressed energy, but they were really simple. It was like, at the core, you are perfect, but you have trauma that is just jamming up your entire system. And that trauma takes the form, it's in an energetic form. And that energy jams itself in your body, and we need to get it out. And if we get it out, your vibration goes up, you begin to create a new reality, even unconsciously. And so that was kind of how it was explained to me. And then it was like, well, let's just do the work. You'll learn as you go. But I saw it as a teacher myself, kind of by nature, I was seeking like, okay, I need some understanding of how this is working. So I started really studying energy itself and quantum physics and how it works and how trauma works on a physics level, you know, because it turns out that, everything is energy, right? So, you know, you yourself, you're about 99% empty space. You know, if you shrink up the space between the atoms and you're actually mostly a bunch of weird subatomic particles that are moving in and out of the quantum vacuum and doing all kinds of fascinating things. I mean, scientists have discovered about 150 different subatomic particles. And the reason it's important to designate subatomic or quantum, whatever term you want to use, is that on a subatomic level, the way that we behave, okay, because your body exists both in a material plane, you know, this solid mass, this kind of meat costume that you're wearing, right? And it exists on a subatomic plane. And if we view it on a subatomic plane below what's called the Planck scale, we view it below the Planck scale, then the way your body behaves according to the rules of space and time completely change. And that's why I really sought to understand that. Okay, so you are energy. That's the term that we use to describe the kind of the fundamental stuff that makes up reality. And that energy is always oscillating between being in the wave form, you know, like water, or being in matter form, you know, like sand. Think of like water and sand. We oscillate between those things. And this is, it's so mysterious. It's mind blowing. And it's worth anybody, if anybody's listening right now is like, what in the hell is he talking about? Just Google the double slit experiment.
Everything you're saying, the websites and stuff, I'll put in the show notes, people. Awesome. So you don't have to take notes if you're listening.
Right on. The double slit experiment is, you know, back in the late 1800s is what started this whole thing, when they started to discover that they were working with photons, you know, which are subatomic particles that make out light, and discovering that they change from wave to particle form, and they tend to behave according to how we observe them. So this is where the law of attraction was born, and all this kind of this understanding that thought and consciousness seems to shape reality. So when I'm working with people, it's all about this. You have shaped this reality. Why? Right? You shaped a reality where you're never going to get, you can't get better. You're done improving as an athlete. Why? Well, and because of this, that's how trauma functions. It lives kind of in our bodies on this quantum level. It's quantum energy. It's subatomic energy. So it works in different rules of space and time. There's no future. There's no past. Everything is now, right? Even physical location, geography is different. So if you have an understanding of that, you can work with it differently. It's just accepting a different set of rules. It's a little bit like, you know, if I'm helping people heal culturally, I have to accept something different, you know, kind of like if you go overseas and all of a sudden you're like, hey, you know, here they do this and there they do that. If I'm going to work with people, I'm not going to work with them. I'm only going to work with them on this material plane as is necessary to help us get to a point where we can dive under. So we talk a lot about how is reality made? How is it created? We talk a lot about the dream state. Why are dreams real until you wake up? Because they are. We experience them as reality. Why can I watch a movie? I can watch Moana and my heart can explode and I can bawl my eyes out. Why? Because it's not real, right? Well, we're clearly creating some sort of reality. So a lot of what I do is helping people just clearly see how they've shaped this reality and then do the work necessary to shape the next one that they'd like to. And how does desire come into play? And so there's a lot, I do a lot of visualization with people. I do a lot of deep meditation work with people. But we learn how to create a new reality and then kind of unearth the old one and work in that subconscious space on a raw energy level so we don't have to dabble in the stories. Now, it's not that we never do, okay? My clients, sometimes we get into trauma, we talk about trauma, but we still only do that. We use memories and traumatic memories as a framework to do this deep energy work. And so I don't know if that explains it completely, but we are, you know, I was taught it as something that's just jamming up your system. I understand now much more what it actually is. Like when we talk about energy, I mean, we are dealing with the substance of the universe. I mean, the universe is mostly empty space, you know, and it's about 1% of it is just pure energy, but you know, the universe is a big place. So, but it's a, but yeah, yeah. We're just, I mean, if you can work on that level, man, you can shift reality so much quicker. It's just amazing.
I think, so you're talking about so many things that are the same that I do in my work too. And I think one of the things that I think is super important, you're talking about therapy and psychology. And I think when you have these resources in your brain of like understanding, when you have intellect and you really want to make sense of things, I think that's often the way that we try to make sense of our stories and our trauma. Right. We try to filter it through this like intellectual process. Even when you talked about these athletes are looking for love. If we try to understand that at a conscious level using our intellect, one thing that I've learned in my own life is that I obviously know some things, but really to question everything that I think I know. Because if I think that I'm trying to get love, I may not even understand what love is. And it's an experience that's beyond our cognition. And I think that's what you're talking about. It's almost like when you're really smart or you really like learn a lot about something, it can actually block you from healing because you're using what you think you know and you're less open to the experience of what you might not understand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's part of how I approach it actually, because I always tell people at the beginning, like, this is going to be partly energy work and partly what I call ego work. And I just see the ego as the kind of thinking mind. And I teach it as an operating system. Your ego is an operating system. And that's the thing, is it's your intellect most often. I have a guy right now, I think he's the smartest person I've ever met. And it's fascinating because his ego so badly wants to hijack everything and just understand it so much that he doesn't actually have to go deal with it. You don't have to feel it.
Yeah.
Right? Because if I can understand my pain, I don't have to feel my pain. And actually, that was one of my critiques when we were at school. Was I saw a lot of people that were so intelligent and their ego was just stepping in and creating all kinds of understanding around these things without ever actually getting into it, really changing, you know, that kind of once I was blind, now I see kind of experience that I see so prevalent in the Christian story and what Jesus was doing, what I think is actually the nature of our energetic systems, our spirits, have that capability of creating that just like once I was blind, now I see we can heal. And then the understanding comes later. But there's a big difference between wisdom and knowledge, right? And the mind will adopt knowledge to stay alive. Wisdom is something that literally flows from spirit, it flows from us as we transform. And so I think that's one of the reasons why faith, this kind of ability to just throw yourself off the cliff of the unknown, is such a huge part of healing. And until we can do that, it's awfully tough to heal, you know? But the way I teach people, you know, when they come in, I have certain techniques and stuff to break that down. And if someone needs more ego work than they do energy work, we do the ego work until the energy, like, I mean, I had one guy, like, for 4 sessions, we finally got to do some energy work because we were just pounding away at his ego and his ego's ability to just organize, categorize, understand, and control, you know, with all his intelligence and all his capabilities. And we do that with basic meditation. Like, here's a practice. Here's what you have to do every day. If you don't do it, nothing's going to work. You know, I tell them right from the beginning, you do this, it'll work. You don't, it won't.
Yeah. And they have to be able to trust you. And I think it's important to acknowledge that all of these these things are defenses. I think I'm safe if I can figure it out and understand it. And ultimately, that makes me believe I can control it to some extent. Right. But it comes down to just surrendering to the process, which I think takes time. So yeah. Even in therapy, I do a lot of the somatic subconscious work. It's like it takes time to even be able to let go of what you think you know before you can go deeper, because you have to feel safe enough. And I think circling back to what you said, a lot of the time when you're in an addiction or something, everything that you think you know hasn't worked. And so you feel broken. And that is often what allows you to be open to something that you might not understand. That's what allows for the surrender, is that brokenness. Yeah. And it's really hard to get there without that.
Yeah. Well, and that's how I would tell people, like, listen, you've been doing therapy for the last 6 years, or you're suffering, you just didn't know it, because that suffering that you went through is the key to the whole thing. If you hadn't suffered that much, you would not be here. So let's be grateful for that, you know, because they're always like, oh, I can't live this way anymore. I'm like, great. That's so great that you climbed this mountain and now you're here.
Totally.
It's not, I don't like to call it rock bottom. I think it's kind of the first, it's like climbing in Alaska, that you get to the top of the first mountain and you see 1,000 more in front of you and you're like, oh, and it's much more of a, you made it. You got to the point where you were ready to heal. That's big. You know, I mean, I often wonder, because I was 33 when I was really that at the top. I was ready to die and like get busy living or get busy dying. And I always wonder like why? I've been an addict since I was like probably 25, been a porn addict and just guilt and shame and I'd had depression as long as I could possibly remember. Like, why did it take me so long? You know, why did some people have to, I mean, I'll get a 19-year-old kid who's got a little anxiety. He's like, I can't live this way anymore. I'm ready to do anything. And I'm like, really? Like, that's incredible. Like, how did you do that?
Congratulations.
Like, yeah, that's amazing. You know, I don't know. I don't understand it.
Yeah. So share a little bit more about that journey for you, the going to church, and you said there was a lot of shame and guilt. What were you, what did you try before it actually worked? And what did you understand about your addiction before you were able to heal it?
Yeah. I honestly, once I set my mind on the healing, I healed pretty fast, but I just tried. The first thing was when I was 27, I was in school, or I was in college to get my bachelor's degree. I went kind of late and I was just in that classic, I was still in the evangelical space, and I was, you know, I started the same as everybody else. I started with all these kind of traditional books, and you know, Every Man's Battle. I don't know if you've heard that book, but that was a big one in the Christian church. Millions of copies sold.
What, I guess backing up though, like, what made you think you had a problem? Like, what was it that made you want to fix it?
Well, you know, that's one of the helpful things about the toxicity, was that you feel really, really, really guilty about anything that's quote unquote sinful. And for me, you know, being evangelical dude, trying to be quote unquote faithful to a marriage that I hated. But I was trying to do I was a good person. I was trying to do the right thing. So I felt really guilty about, you know, just wanting to look at porn. And I wasn't a binger guy. I wasn't doing crazy, you know, let's go pay for hookers or something. I was just a little bit of free porn every day gets you by. And the problem was, I didn't have much curiosity towards, like, why is this such a problem? Because I was so lost in, I was so unconscious. I was like a zombie, just lost in guilt, just guilt all the time. Because I was raised with sex was not talked about, not seen, not heard, not talked about. And I had zero input. I mean, zero. I did not know what the word masturbation meant till I was 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And I mean, guys would joke about it in the locker room in high school, and I'd be like, haha, yeah, that's funny. You know, and try not to look like an idiot. But I had zero understanding, zero education, zero anything. I just had a really angry God that I was raised with that was required everything from me. So, you know, over the years, I kind of finally bled the truth to my wife a little bit. Hey, this is something I go through. And we went into the, what's the church going to tell us to do? And I read Every Man's Battle, and I tried to do the whole, they have this technique where it's bounce your eyes. You just try to, every time you see in a sexual image of any sort, you just bounce your eyes away. But I just looking like I had tics all the time. You know, you go into a grocery store or something like that, you're at the magazine rack and you're twitching, trying to bounce your eyes all over the place. And it was just, after a while, I think that was really helpful for me, because trying to do the Christian solutions, the evangelical solutions, was so ineffective that for the first time I started really going, God, I can't believe that this is all we've got. Like, that book that we have, the Bible, is so full of just huge, gigantic, powerful stories. I mean, oceans parting and, you know, people rising from the dead. I'm just like, there's gotta be something else. But it was the first time I dared to, like, turn towards the church, my beliefs, and go, you gotta help me. And then I started after a while. I don't know why. Maybe it was my twin brother and I were kind of going through this together. And I think that his courage, he had more courage than I do to question the beliefs, to look at it and go, this should work. But we'd been raised with a belief system that you don't like, kind of like, touch not God's anointed, and don't question anything ever, like ever. And I really didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to look at my beliefs and go, this should work. Because that was, to me, like it was taught to me, it was a lack of faith. If you expected anything from it, you had that, then you didn't really believe. You had to be able to believe without seeing. And after a while, I started going, this seems silly to me, because like Jesus and even Paul is talking about the demon. You know, I came to you preaching Christ and him crucified, and in a demonstration of the power of the Holy Spirit. I'm like, there should be healing. This should work. And I started down that path gradually. But then I had an experience when my brother went to the White Raven Center. He was living in Anchorage, and he went there, and he just called me freaking out one day. Like, he said he cast a demon out of himself, and he said, I'm not an addict anymore. And I'm like, whoa, like, slow down, man. And he's explaining me to this story. And I'm just like, I remember hanging up the phone, and my wife, I had it on speaker. My wife goes, do you think that's biblical? And for the very first time, I was like, because what I heard was so real, it was so true, that I was like, holy crap. Like, all my belief systems just immediately were up for questioning. And I looked at her and I go, and I'd always been the answer guy, but I just went, I don't know. I go, do you know how old that book is? And I go, whatever that is, I got to get that. And so I started, hey, he would go do a session at White Raven, and he'd call me and go, well, I just did this. And I would go do it. I would just lay down for 20 minutes and breathe as deep as you can or something like that. And then pretty soon I started to feel. And that was the whole thing. They were saying, if you can feel it, you can heal it. If it can be felt, you can actually do the healing. And so the whole goal was to look. So I look back now, and all I was trying to do at first was learn how to feel. And it was about a meditative process of paying attention to what your body's experiencing. And, you know, and I'd had knots in my stomach for years, like 5 years. They hadn't gone away. 24/7, I could feel knots in my stomach. And that was like, man, that was such torture. I had tics and everything, severe anxiety. And I just started, but within a couple of weeks, I could feel this thing inside me. And I was like, holy crap. I'm like, I could feel something weird, especially if I looked at porn or something like that. I'd feel this kind of heavy, dark thing in me. And it was like this, I think it's in my whole body. And then one day I just asked my wife, I said, hey, I thought maybe you could like pray for me and we could try to get it out. Because my brother had this experience. And so I'm like, oh, let's try to get it out. And we didn't know what we were doing. We've been raised with this kind of hellfire and brimstone, demons are everywhere thing, but we didn't understand any of it, especially in the light of modern psychology. My wife had a bachelor's degree in counseling psychology. And no, she had a master's degree in counseling psychology at this point when she did this. So she was a therapist. She was literally a play therapist. And she goes, all right, well, okay, sure. We got nothing to lose. Let's give it a shot. I laid down on her bed. She put her hand on my chest and she started this kind of wonky prayer, like, hey, God, we think there might be something in this. We wonder if you could help us get it out. It was like that. And then I freaked out. My body just went crazy. And I started to get like hyperventilating and getting thrown all over the bed. I'm just like rocking all over the bed. She's like, whoa, are you all right? I'm like, I don't know. Just keep going. Whatever you're doing, just keep going. I was like, ugh. I'm trying to breathe and I'm gagging and stuff. And it was like something out of a movie. Mm-hmm. And then she just kept going and it, boom, it knocked me out cold. And she said I was out for almost an hour with all my muscles like flexed and my eyes were rolled back in my head. And then when I came to, my body started relaxing, but it was still there. And then I said, she's like, oh, I think it's gone. And I guess I didn't know I'd been out. I thought this was like, this whole thing was like a little 3 or 4 minute experience, but she said I was out cold later on. Cause I told a story to somebody and she's like, you were out cold for like an hour. I was calling people and trying to figure out what to do. I was like, what? And then anyway, she kept going. When I came to, she kept going. And then I felt, and then I got, it was strange. I mean, if I told you the whole experience, it's pretty wild, to be honest with you. And
yeah. So I want to jump in really quick and just say like, this is pretty weird, like what you're saying.
Yeah,
and
right.
So how do you deal when people are like, this guy's kooky? Like, what is he talking about? Like energy can be really overwhelming for people. They don't get it. And
huge.
It's
well, and if I'm honest, Jazz, I don't tell this story that often because people don't know where to put it, especially in light of if you're a Christian and you were raised with some sort of spiritual warfare paradigm, because what this was, eventually this thing literally pulled right out of my body and it was nasty. It was like and then my addiction was gone. I mean, that was the end of my porn addiction. It was gone. I'd had it for 7 years and it was gone that day. And it was weird though, because I woke up the next morning, I couldn't see straight and I was dizzy. Like my whole energetic being had shifted. And then I went to church that morning and it was like, had this weird experience. And I was like, what in the world? And then 2 months later after that, I couldn't go to church anymore. Cause I was like, this, they're talking about, you know, playing with Legos and I'm experiencing a nuclear bomb going off inside me. And so, but it began this exploration where I was going, okay, well, what is this? And I was kind of freed of, instead of looking after, you know, horns and pitchforks, I was just looking at it as energy, going, okay, that whatever that was, it was energy, but that energy had consciousness. And that's a big part of what I deal with is that I'm not just, I mean, I've got pro athletes that are pulling demonic entities out of their body. And we're not calling it demons and we're not working in spiritual warfare. They're just learning that it's energy. And they never have crazy exorcism experiences like I had because I've learned a certain level of mastery of how to work with energy in the raw. But if you acknowledge it sometimes as having consciousness, you know, call it an entity. I just call it entities, but that, and that this is kind of a normal part of being a human. It helps I have guys that have done, you know, and women who've done unbelievably deep work. I had a girl come to me and she'd had a massive eating disorder, severe anxiety. I mean, 6 weeks, it was gone. All of it. She literally said later, she's like, I think I healed about 97% of my trauma. And we did such deep work. And she was dealing with entities like this, but she was working on this level of mastery that it didn't require all the dramatics. And I had asked, you know, Floyd up in Alaska, I'm like, why was mine so crazy violent? And he goes, you're just completely identified with it. All the devils and demons and horns and, you know, hell. I mean, I was so terrified of hell. I mean, I could tell you stories like this all day long about my own personal work and the work that, you know, that I've done with people. But for me, it was always really intense, really, really, really intense. And that's after that, I was at the Seattle school 6 months later. Cause I was just going, whatever happened to me right there, I've got to, you know, and I never told that story until the very end. I never told anybody while I was there that I was doing this kind of energy work because I could see really clearly that everybody here was kind of, you know, even though it's the most beautiful place in the world, it was still very, very ego-oriented towards the intellect and towards the mind. I still remember at my last class there, I was doing a reading group with a bunch of people and Shelley was leading it. Shelley Stern, she's this beautiful, beautiful, brilliant theologian, but she doesn't really have a paradigm for this kind of stuff. And one guy named Nathan, he's asked this question. He's like, it just feels to me like there should be a more embodied way of doing this kind of therapeutic work. Mm-hmm. And I finally went, I kind of hit the table and everybody like looks at me and I'm like, all right, I'm just going to tell you guys some things that since we're almost done here, I've never told anybody at the school that this work that I've been doing. And by then, of course, 4 years in, I'd been doing all kinds of, I mean, I was finding shamans and mystical healers and doing energy work and going, I mean, I was doing all kinds of stuff just because I was like, I need to learn about this stuff. I need to learn about this world. And I was reading quantum physics and I was doing all this kind of stuff and I'm listening and listening and listening. And I'm bringing it all into this space where I'm like, where ultimately I can realize now that I was thinking there's gotta be a way to actually heal. Not just a way to learn how to live with our demons and not just a way to learn how to reorient ourselves towards our pain, which is helpful, you know, but I was like, there's gotta be a way to actually heal. If the body can do it, the soul can do it. And so that's really my work now is just helping people heal permanently from PTSD. And I do it in a way that if, you know, I have people get scared of it, you know, cause they're scared of, you know, I had this guy, I'm working with this guy in the NFL right now. And he was afraid for months. He was dancing around. I should come do some work with him. I'm like, yeah, I'm here ready for you. And once we got into it, he's like, whoa, this is so easy. And I'm like, yeah, because it's just raw energy. And if you have any awareness of who you really are and what kind of power you really have inside you, it's not that hard. So people don't, I don't have people dredging up all kinds of pain and puking all over themselves. It's just, we've just learned how to work at that third level. And when you work there, it's not difficult. It's still pain, you know, it's still pain for sure. And it can get a little messy at times because you start unraveling your pain, it unravels your life. I mean, most of us, all our relationships, our families, our jobs, everything is wound up in our pain. We've created systems with our trauma. And so when you start healing your trauma, those systems start to unravel. So there's people like, I mean, I've had people get divorced after working with me. I've had people, you know, leave bad marriages, quit jobs, you know, just do all kinds of fascinating stuff because they're like, this doesn't work anymore, you know? But then, they usually call me 2 years later and everything's changed and they're accomplishing their dreams, you know? So
I think a big piece of what you're talking about is this, this connection with the truth, which is a big part of my work too. Mm-hmm. Like it can feel really hard, but you're motivated to do it because you know on some level that it's true, what you're experiencing and what you're feeling. You're not reading it in a book and trying to make sense of it. It's like your body knows that it's real and it's true.
Right, right. Yeah, that's well said.
So powerful.
Yeah. That's why I still am a Christian, because I go back to these stories of Jesus just bringing people they're helping. He was just giving space for people to know that truth within themselves. He said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And people go, you know, that's not a theological truth. It's your own truth. It's being able to know deeply who you are and get past some of the stories you learned that you were taught about yourself. And that's where that psychodynamic stuff comes in really well too. It really helps with that. But then what if we took that truth even deeper and we went into the truth of what we are as energetic beings at the core, like the very nature, the very raw nature of your created self, of your own soul. If we could go that deep, we could heal deeper. And then healing becomes, I heard a guy at sales school one time, he said, good psychology is good theology. And I was like, and vice versa. And I'm like, that makes sense. Because what if psychology was meant to put us on a path to enlightenment, like Buddha level stuff? I mean, what if that's really good psychology is that? It's beyond, you know, behavioral shifts, you know? And that's the goal, man, is that, you know, if I can create someone who's successful and happy and really is on a place where the ceiling just gets lifted off and all of a sudden you can just keep growing the rest of your life. You know, that's really what it should be, I think.
You know, one thing I'm really aware of as you're talking is how much strength it takes for you and I to do this work because of what we're battling with in people. Like we're battling with things that they have built to protect themselves their whole lives. Right, and I'm thinking about some of the clients that I've been working with. Like I will risk them leaving therapy by speaking the truth in a way that some people might think is aggressive, not aggressive, but it's so direct and there's no bullshit in what I'm saying. Yeah. And the way that people respond to that is amazing, but you have to, it takes, I think it's like, sometimes see myself as like, it's a battle that we're fighting to help people heal. Like they just don't even, there's so much.
Well, that's why they have to be ready. If someone comes to me and they're not ready, I don't even try. I just go, oh, you know, when you're ready. I actually give, it's funny, Jazz, like every client that I work with, when I sign people up, I do 12 sessions. We pay in 12 session blocks. And the goal is to have them done by 12. But they, you know, and sometimes they re-up and do another set or whatever. But one of the things I do right from the beginning is I go, well, let's see how ready you are. Here's the homework. And it's a 10 minutes type of meditation. Here's the type of meditation you're going to do. You can do it every day for 10 minutes. If you do this, you will heal. If you don't, you won't. And it's fascinating because they'll come back the next week and, you know, I did it once. I'll go, why? And I remember one guy was like, well, you know, I've done meditation before and it just doesn't seem to really help me. I go, oh, you thought I was trying to help you. I go, I'm not. I'm just trying to see if you'll do what I say. That's it. You know, if you're ready to heal, you'll do what I tell you to do. I'm telling you, this will work. And you have to believe me. And it's always kind of a test of whether they're actually ready or not. And when they are, they'll just, you know, when you'll get people who are like, they're so ready. Like I did 30 minutes a day and I just, wow. And maybe they're frustrated the whole time, but they're like, I'm so desperate to heal. And those are the people that heal really, really quick, you know? But I've had people where it's like, after six sessions, it's like, what are we doing here, man? You know? And I'll lay into them. I'm not your babysitter. I said that to one person one time. I am not your fucking babysitter. You are wasting my time. And I know they're paying me, but I don't give a shit. Like, I'm like, I'm not here to be your babysitter and help you make you feel better about yourself. If you want to work with me, we have to do this. And usually somebody, you know, if you kick them in the butt a little bit, they'll go for it. But I care too much about what I do. People heal themselves, but I care about what I spend my time doing a lot. And, and I'm getting to the point now where it works so well that I'm like, hey, you came to me. I don't go hunt. That's another thing. I don't market. I don't hunt at all, ever. Mm-hmm. The most I've ever done is every once in a while I'll pop something. If I got a spot opened up, I'll pop it on Facebook or something like that. But that's it. And that's kind of that, even though that's hard to build a business that way, I did it. And over time now I have a kind of a constant stream of just people coming because the word of mouth is just out there and people are just coming. And then, you know, job offers, whatever, all that stuff just comes now. So I did that work. And the cool thing is that the people that come, they need it. You know, they when they come, they need it. Very few people come to me without some level of desperation, which means people heal really quick. That's always helpful, but you know, when you work with people that aren't ready, then your job's not to help them heal. Your job's to help them get ready. You know, it shifts everything. Like, you have to be able to show them their own suffering. Well, how do you do that? That's hard. You got to speak some serious truth, you know?
Totally. And even that framework of it's your job, it's like, as a therapist, and this is part of why it's so powerful that for us to do our own work too, especially when we were in school, of like believing that it's my job. So does that mean if I fail, if they don't do it, I'm a failure? Like, no, it's not my job to be responsible for somebody else's work, but I can create a space for them to show up if that's what they want to do. Right. But also, like, it's really hard to be with somebody if they want you to collude with their victim mentality or their powerlessness. Like, I can't do that. It's soul crushing for me to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had clients like that before where they start in, I go, you're not a victim. I say, you're not a victim. And it is soul crushing. And I won't do it anymore, to be honest with you, Jazz. Like, at the beginning, you know, I'm back in a place where I'm trying to start a business and this is my only money coming in, and how am I going to survive? How am I going to put food on the table for my own family? I would try more, and I would take clients that are, you know, well, they want some help, but you can tell they're not ready. And now, if they're not ready, I'll just, I'll have one really good conversation when somebody emails me and says, hey, I'd like to work with you. I go, well, let's jump on the phone. I'll spend an hour on the phone with them just gauging whether they're ready or not. Mm-hmm. And letting them know and speaking such intense truth to them that they'll know whether they really want to do it or not. And some totally. Do and some don't. And some people are just so desperate. They're like, yeah, let's do it. I'm in. Let's go. You know, I had a guy just recently, actually, 4 years ago, he paid me for 12 sessions. And never used him, just bailed. I didn't hear from him for like a year. And just recently, he got a hold of me and said, hey, can I still use those? And I'm like, well, I charge twice as much as I used to, but it sounds like you're ready now. So let's go ahead and do it. And he's doing it. He's healing. He has serious acute trauma, like real, real serious acute trauma. And he's healing it. He's doing the work because he's ready. So
when people pay you 12 sessions and then you get in a fight with their ego or whatever and they leave, do you give them their money back or how does that work?
No. Yeah, I don't give them money back. I just say the sessions are there for you when you're ready. You can come back. Yeah, I had a guy do that once. Paid me for 12 sessions and I told him, just so you know, you pay, you're in, you're committed. I'm not, this is how it is, and I tell everybody that. But after one session, he was an evangelical guy. After one session, he had a really intense porn addiction and I could feel he had a demonic entity in his chest and I could feel it. Cause that's another thing. I'm pretty psychic. And so I could feel it. And we started chatting about my story and that kind of thing. And he told me, he, at the end of the session, that he called me the next day and he said, I just think this, what you're doing is evil. It's wicked. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. He actually used that word. I'm like, Hassan, he goes, well, I'd like a refund. And I said, no, I ain't giving you a refund, man. I go, you wasted my time. I just tell him that you're the one wasting my time. You don't know what you're talking about and you're still an addict. I said, those sessions will be here when and if you're ever ready.
Ooh, yeah. That's the trick about the addiction too, is if you're an addict, you want to run away from your negative feelings, right? So I can make you the bad guy so that I don't have to look at myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's too bad because it reminds me of the rich young ruler, that story in the Bible. Remember when the guy comes in and it says that Jesus, you know, loved him, even though he walked away, when Jesus like really put him to the test. Are you actually ready or not? You know? And that's how I feel about guys like that, right? I go, man, but I get it. I mean, I have this question still at the heart of what I do. Like, why didn't I go earlier? Why didn't I question things sooner? Why was I in that store bouncing my eyes everywhere with some ridiculous idea that was going to change me? You know, it's just, I still remember at one point driving up and I'm in Portland, Oregon, and I'm at a stoplight and there's a 50-foot mural of a rock star energy drink, you know, porn star in a bikini, right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, trying to keep my head down, but I have to look up at the light and I'm like, and I finally went, I literally out loud, I was like, what chance do we stand? Like, if this is the answer, we're dead. You know, well, there's got to be something deeper. And that started my journey towards this, man. It's just a gigantic, I think of my work as a giant research project. I am just learning more and more and more and more about the core of what makes us human and how to heal and how to change that. And the different crazy layers. It is a bit of a Pandora's box. You get into energy work because when you're working in the subatomic space, all bets are off. The rules of space and time change. And it's just, it becomes this anything is possible kind of experience. And it's really fun because I get to watch people heal. And I mean, when I, 10 years ago, I was depressed, anxiety ridden, addicted, you know, purposeless, meaningless, miserable human being. And now I get to get up every single day and just do what I love. and it's wonderful.
I love that so much. And I just keep thinking about as you're talking, just this idea of love and sitting at that stoplight with this big thing right in front of you. Yeah. Like, I can't even imagine how much self-loathing is going through your mind as you're trying to like not look, but you have to look in what's happening.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we don't want to have these rigid structures that we can survive in, but we want to have freedom. Mm-hmm. And that happens from going deep down inside and removing whatever's in there that doesn't belong in there, whether it's a demonic energy or a false belief or some, you know, self-loathing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then when people come to us and they're not necessarily ready to do the work, we can show up for them without judgment and like know that, okay, well, this is where they're at in their lives and that's okay. Like, we can still love them in that experience, which is, it doesn't mean that they have failed.
Right.
It's all about accessing love and freedom.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing about freedom. I don't know. My first book was called Feels Like Redemption. And the working title, the original title of it, they wouldn't let us use it, the publisher, but it was called Porn Pilgrim. And the subtitle was The Search for Freedom You Can Feel. Because I saw a world describing freedom as a behavioral set. Like, if you don't look at porn, then you are free. When I was like, if you wake up every day and you're still thinking about it all the time, how does that make you free? I'm like, it should be something you feel in your body. Like, I should feel, I should wake up. I think everybody kind of fundamentally just wants to wake up and go, man, I feel great. Like, I think that's like the core of all human motivation. We just want to wake up in the morning and no matter what your life is, just go, man, I feel really good today, you know, and I'm going to go out and tackle whatever. And I, you know, that's the idea, is to do that. We has to be just, it's in the body and people have to be ready to do that work because it is, I understand why it's scary. I do. And for me, it wasn't scary because I was at a point where I wanted to die, but I understand why people resist the way they do, for sure.
So one thing, last thing that I want to talk about, I'm just curious your thoughts on this. So pornography is a problem in a lot of relationships.
Yeah.
And so what would you say about just, what is your thought on pornography use in general? And when you talk to couples, like, is it, sounds like you and your wife had a really healthy healing process together for that, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, it's not always the case. I'm pretty lucky, to be honest with you. My wife, well, you know, and it's funny because she was just the other side of the coin where I had this like super intense relationship with my sexuality and pornography and that kind of stuff. She had this like super repressed relationship with her sexuality. So she was just the other side of the same coin where it was like her sexuality had been so repressed inside of her that it was like this, it was just this nothingness space, this kind of barren desert. And for me, it was just this super intense thing. And I think that some of the grace that she gave me was from that perspective. She had this inner knowing that I'm just as jacked up as you are. It's just showing up differently. And you know, of course, inside the Christian space, her, the way it showed up for her was sanctioned and the way it showed up for me wasn't. But when I deal with people, I mean, I deal, because of my pilgrimage, you know, I deal with people with porn addictions constantly. Like, it's a pretty common experience that I have in therapy. And I mean, I would say 98% of the guys who work with me, they're done with their porn addiction in 6 and 8 weeks. It's gone. And it's because all we do is just recognize that porn's not your problem. And I'm working with a couple right now, actually. And at first the woman was just so, because he has a porn addiction, she's just disgusted. She's like, did you see the advertisements that they have on these sites? And I'm like, well, yeah, you know. And all I did was just show her after a while. I'm like, you know, what you have here, I try to lift them up to 1,000 feet so they can kind of see each other from a more elevated position. I said, it's just a story. It's all it is, like anything else, you know, shopping addiction, gambling addictions, video game addictions. They're all just narratives that the ego adopts in order to heal or help meet the needs of these fractured young parts of us. You know, I'll ask guys all the time when I'm dealing with porn addiction, I'll go, hey, you a boob guy or an ass guy? And they're always like, what? Go, yeah, simple question, man. Boob guy or an ass guy? And they'll kind of like sheepishly like, well, you know, I'm a boob guy. And like, oh, interesting. That's a very nurturing narrative, isn't it? And they're like, what? Like, ultimately, it's a baby to the boob. It feels nurturing. And ask guys, it's a power narrative. That's all it is. You know, it's power and it's nurturing. And it's an industry that exists because of supply and demand, because we are massively wounded as a human race. And we all fail to get the love, the unconditional love we really need in those first 10 years of our life. And so we find these supplemental narratives. You know, that's how most people treat money. Money is designed to create a narrative of safety and security. When safety and security doesn't exist, it's not real. It's a make-believe concept. But, you know, I've had pro athletes like, why don't I ever feel like I have enough money? You know? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, 'cause that's how trauma works. The second you meet the need continues, because trauma is this kind of time loop experience. But it is with pornography specifically, porn's not the problem. It's just medication. It's medication for a very specific kind of problem. And if you help people heal that trauma, the need simply falls away. And then all of a sudden they can start asking really helpful questions about my sexuality. What is it? And what do I want? How do I want? And why do I want? I mean, I had this guy come to me recently, actually, and he had this super fractured, compartmentalized sexuality. I mean, it was all kinds of radical, kind of, you know, wild stuff. And then he had over on the side, he had the wife with the kids and the perfect picture. And he had, it was like a compartmentalized, like five different compartments, and he had everything kind of sealed off from everything else. And we just started doing this deep healing work, and now everything is starting to integrate. And he's taking a vacation right now. He said, we're going to have a truth-telling vacation, 2 weeks, staying at home, but not working. And we're going to be, literally him and his wife are scheduling meetings with each other just so he can finally start speaking the truth about what he thinks, what he feels, what he's been going through, what he's been doing. Like, it's all just because we've been just bringing him into this integrated space where instead of being five different people trying to get all these different needs met in all these profoundly, you know, kind of wild ways, he's just becoming one person with one thought, feeling, need, and desire, and being able to express it in this space. And that's the whole idea, is just integrate, you know, and then you don't need it anymore. But, you know, it makes sense. If you got some 3-year-old inside you that's all fractured and looking for, just needs to cuddle with mom, porn's pretty helpful. I can touch a button and I've got beautiful women. They're just like, anything you want. Mm-hmm. You know, that's for Christian guys, that's very priestly almost. Like, here's a blessing on your desires. You have these desires, I will not judge you. You can have whatever you want. And it's unfortunate, but most people, our interaction with God and our relationships don't have that level of unconditional love. But of course, most of us lost that so early that, you know, it can't, it's like a vacuum. It just can't, you can't get, you know, my wife was never capable of giving me what I demanded and what I needed. And that wasn't her job, and she never could. I had to do it myself. And now my sexuality is a very integrated thing that, you know, I can share it and experience it how I want to, and she can be a part of that. Mm-hmm. My wife and we only have one promise to each other now. It's just honesty. That's it. We always tell the truth. Mm-hmm. We always share everything. And, you know, and that's it. You know, I don't know whether we'll be married the rest of our lives. We let go of all that kind of stuff. And I think that when people begin to heal, that their sexuality is a space that you can start expressing your real creative truth, you know, and there's such a beautiful thing in that, inside that space. But I don't know, I'm kind of rambling all over the place. It's such a big topic too. You can really explore that. But the goal is that people stop thinking it's such a big deal. You know what I mean? Women and men, like, you betrayed me because you've looked at porn. I'm like, well, that paradigm is really, really, really archaic. It's very childish for any woman to go, because my husband's a porn addict, he has betrayed me in some way. And I get it, because that's what we were sold, especially Christians. They were sold that, right? You stand at the altar and you make these promises. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, you don't know, you know what I mean? And you don't know what better or worse is, and you have no idea what this is. And then you have this strange type of thing. They sold us this thing where we kind of owned each other in some weird way. There's like this possession, and there's this weird possession that happens. I own you, you own me. I mean, we really, your body is mine. I mean, that's how we were, me and my wife were sold. And after a while, you just kind of go, that's dumb, you know? Mm-hmm. But when you start to look at your spouses or those people's, like, their addictions with more curiosity, you know, and going, why does that appeal to you? I remember the first time my wife really started going, what kind of porn do you like? And I'm like, and I wasn't even an addict anymore, but it's not that pornography goes away. She just started getting curious about it, because I don't look at it. But she's like, but what kind of stuff did you like? I'm like, you want to know what kind of porn I was into? She's like, yeah. And I was, okay. And one day I just spent time showing her, and she was just like, she was seeing patterns, and she was saying, oh, I can see why you like, oh, that makes sense. She started kind of putting it all together, and I'm like, huh. And she was really, I mean, she got really curious about it and as to why, because we were starting to view each other as such complex beings instead of these simple behavioral, you know, machines. And that really helped a lot, I think.
I think, I mean, we could replace porn with food or productivity or exercise or money or shopping or whatever. It's the same. It's always, it's a defense or a coping mechanism.
It's just a story. My wife was a shopping addict at the same time I was a porn addict. I mean, she would hide thousands of dollars and a new outfit showing up every day. And I'm like, where did you get that? And she'd go, oh, I've had this for years. And I go, really? I'd be so confused until one day I finally grabbed another package off the porch. I'm like, what is going on here? And then she broke out crying. She said, you know, but for her, it was a story of abundance because, of course, her trauma was the opposite of that. You know, she had this wrestle with intense poverty trauma inside of her. And, you know, it's just whatever narrative. I mean, that's religion too. I mean, that's the thing. And for us, it was an addiction. Every Sunday we go there and we get fed. And I just got to get my... You know, the pastor brought the meat today, you know, and I get my, and the kind of the God man in the sky kind of gives me the blessing. And now I can go and, you know, slog through my week until I can get back to the thing. It looks a lot more like addiction than it does devotion. You know?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we're all, I think when you talked about, you know, the wedding ceremony, we're all mixed up on what we think we're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't stop and question because of what you talked about. Right. Having an angry God. And if you ask questions, then you must be lacking faith.
Right.
There's so much fear. So what would our lives look like if we weren't afraid?
Yeah.
They'd be totally different.
Totally different. But that fear exists because it's protecting us. And so we have we just have to allow ourselves to get super curious about, I mean, even the most subtle thing, even the subtle expressions of trauma, insecurity. If someone, you know, insecurity, jealousy, control issues, you know, you're being a bad listener. Like really, those are all subtle expressions of trauma. All of them. Mm-hmm. And people go, well, that's just totally normal, right? And I go, well, yeah, if you think trauma is normal, which I guess you could say that, it's normal. All human beings carry it. Mm-hmm. But if you let yourself get curious and go, can I heal that? You could. Mm-hmm. You could become a very secure person. You could become a great listener. You could become someone who doesn't have to control anybody. And you really could if you let yourself be curious about how those things are expressing themselves in your life.
Yeah. And then the part about how it could change potentially your whole life. Like it might end your marriage. You might want to leave your job. Like that's actually, it's pretty big, but it's
huge.
The question of like, would you want to live an inauthentic life where you push your true self away or it's hard connecting and being in the truth and it's not socially acceptable most of the time, which is fine because I'd rather have that in my life than like authenticity versus pretending to be something that I'm not.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's everything. If we can just, at the end of the day, at my funeral, I don't care what they say as long as they say that he was honest and he was true. That's it. If they can say he was his authentic self and we all benefited from it, like that's everything, man. That is everything.
Which is why you're in this work, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And even if people say nothing about you at your funeral, that's okay too, because you lived your purpose and it's your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I actually, it's funny you say that because I think about it a lot. I think about legacy a lot. I think about this, you know, I have kids and when you have kids, I think it kind of drives you into that space a little bit. I think most parents, they start reflecting more about what they're leaving behind, you know, and that kind of legacy and this idea of like, why was I here? You know, I'll be 45 in a few weeks and I'm kind of into that second half now. And I think about maybe... I don't know. Maybe it's a good practice. I'm just examining it because I'm looking at it just going, I want to make sure that when I leave here, that it meant something. You know what I mean? That's important to me. And maybe I'm unique that way, but it's a very important thing to me to have been here in a way that made the world a better place, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you did for sure for like even just one person who you worked with that you saw access the truth. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe
go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Jen. Yes.
I was just going to say, maybe we can do a whole nother episode on death and our funerals because it's,
we could probably just go for the next like 3 hours. Like there's so much because it all leads into something else, right? But we could talk about enlightenment and where we go from here and let's have an episode called what scares us, you know, and let's just, you know, we can just talk forever, but I'll be here and we'll keep chatting whenever. Yeah. As soon as the world allows us, you and I are going to grab a coffee too.
Be nice. Yep, totally. And I'll dance with your wife because I miss dancing.
Yes. That's an area where I've still got some trauma bound up in that. I am still officially an inhibited dancer. So I've been watching you're dancing with curiosity, because I know that like dancing in public is still something for me that would trigger me pretty bad. And I think there's something in that, and I'm curious about it, but I've held it at an arm's length for sure. For sure.
Oh, I mean, we could do a whole nother episode on dancing, right? But that's why I post the videos. I'm not a good dancer. I'm not doing it because of it's freedom. It's a feeling of being connected and being at peace with myself and like whatever happens and not caring so much what other people think about me.
Yeah.
Which is such a gift. I never used to be like that.
It's funny because I have a great friend and she's a professional choreographer down in LA and she's an amazing dancer, world-class. And her name is Jasmine as well. And we just had a talk a few weeks ago and she's like, you got to come dance. And just when she started going, hey, you really, I'm going to LA next week. And she's like, you should come in. And I'm like, and it triggered me. Like I could feel it in my body. Like there's something that happens when someone says, come dance in front of other people that makes my body seize up. It's just fascinating. So I've got some work to do there for sure. For sure.
Yeah. And so the last thing I think we'll say, we'll like bookmark this and then probably come back to many of these other things. But I think it's really important to acknowledge that everybody's existing in their own version of reality.
Yeah.
So even like thinking about the legacy piece that you're going to leave, everyone sees what you've done through their own lens and through their own story and their own wounding, the same way that I can dance freely and it's no problem for me. Yeah. Your story is totally different. Like whatever my experience is not going to be the same as your experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of us have our own stories and we can connect with that from a space of love, knowing that it's okay to be whoever we are, but looking at why it's there.
Yeah, that's a good reminder. That's very much, I think that's been one of my big growth hedges is just more and more just recognizing everyone's path is just, it's theirs and it's unique. And I'm pretty vulnerable with my clients and stuff about my own weaknesses and my own struggles. I'm pretty honest about that kind of thing. I think it's encouraging and important. But you know, and you still have a choice whether to leave it or go into it. For me, I'm going to have to make a choice at some point, you know, to actually like, okay, this summer is my summer of dancing, you know?
Yes.
And go into it. So for sure.
It's a little easier on Zoom. Maybe that's a good start. So
there you go. There you go. That's a positive.
Try that. Well, Seth, thank you so much. So why don't you tell everybody where they can find you?
You know, where you can find me, it depends on what you want to do. I've got a lot of different stuff going on. My whole world of youth sports and the therapeutic resources I created for that is a company called IANI Training, IANNI, IANITraining.com. And we work trying to help parents that are in the sports space, parents and coaches and stuff, to become more aware of themselves as they're raising kids that are athletes, trying to end the whole world of parent trauma. The porn addiction stuff and a lot of that, the anxiety stuff and that kind of thing. And I have a website called mypilgrimage.com and we have a community on Facebook and there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, most of that's free too. We just give tons of videos and tons of stuff. If someone's looking for an alternative that is a kinder, deeper, more beautiful way of approaching issues around porn addiction and depression and anxiety, SethAllenTaylor.com, Allen with one N, A-L-A-N. SethAllenTaylor.com is my site, and that's where my mentorship groups and my life coaching. If somebody's actually wanting to do work with me, you can find it there. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Are you on social media? Do you have Instagram or Facebook?
Yeah, Instagram, but I don't do any of it commercially. I don't do anything professionally. You can find Seth Allen Taylor on Facebook or at SethTaylor40. Is my Instagram, but that's just, you know, see pictures of my cute kids and stuff. I'm not a big marketing guy. And I think that that's one of the reasons I was so poor for so long, but I just saw it as a journey. Very, very pilgrimage-like in my professional work. I just decided I was going to work with whoever came to me. And if they came to me, then great. And if they didn't, then there was no money. And that was going to help me in my own personal work because it would trigger me. But then, you know, Rob Bell was one of my mentors. And he told me, he said, if it helps people, it'll sell. Because you just keep getting good at it. His whole thing was mastery. You just get incredibly good at something and then people will pay you whatever you want. And so gradually it's just built and built and built, but pretty much all my work has been word of mouth or somebody read a book or, you know, my pilgrimage is one of those kind of, it's like banned literature in the Christian church where people are handing it under the table. Hey man, try this, you know? So but you can find me at all those spots and if somebody wants to connect then feel free to reach out.
Yeah. I think you said it earlier in our conversation, but just removing all of these negative, toxic things, and then your light can shine brighter and people can find you, which is what you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's less stressful. It was stressful for a while because there was no money, but then after a while, when stuff just keeps coming, you don't really have to think about trying to find clients. It's nice, but it took me, about 5 years to build that. So I had to be willing to, if you're okay with just eating like top ramen and stuff, you can accomplish a lot. So
cool. All right. Well, we will talk soon then.
All right, Jess. It was wonderful.
Hey guys, it's Jasmine. Thanks so much for listening to the Live Your Life podcast, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find the show notes and information about life coaching at jasminesavari.com. You can also find me on Instagram at jasminesavari. I am a life coach and a licensed mental health counselor, but this podcast is not a replacement for healthcare services. If you are in crisis, please call 911 or the Crisis Clinic at 1-800-273-8255. Take care and don't forget to live your life.